It is Friday, April 27, 2012. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Later on this edition of Ozarks, we'll have a tour of a new hospital in Siloam Springs. W.Dale Warren gives us a preview of the last two University of Arkansas Symphony concerts of the season. And we'll meet seven of the 14 moms who will be on Walton Arts Center stage Sunday for Listen to Your Mother.
Mount Sequoia Retreat and Conference Center features Music on the Mountain, the first Tuesday of every month. Walk-up tickets are available with proceeds to benefit the Restore Clap Auditorium. Food and coffee will be provided. MountSequoia.org for more information.
Theater Squared Season 6 concludes with The Fall of the House, playing now through May 6th at Walton Arts Center's Nadine Baum Studio. In this mystery, spanning two centuries, T2 Artistic Director Robert Ford explores the desperate bargains we make for love. Tickets and more information for The Fall of the House available at theater2.org or 443-5600.
If you drive north on Progress Avenue in Siloam Springs, you'll see that it's a very aptly named road. To the left, you'll notice the brand new high school. To the right, you'll see the recently constructed Siloam Springs Regional Hospital, which is set to open its doors Saturday. If you visited the new building earlier this week, you may have seen a worker wiring the red emergency sign on the front of the hospital, or perhaps you stepped aside as a group of men in matching blue t-shirts moved a large commercial printer down the hallway toward the Human Resources Department. Kathy Davis, the Director of Marketing and Business Development, says the hospital has been a dream of the community for quite some time. The new facility is more than 92,000 square feet, about double the size of the current hospital, which is located about 3 miles away on Jefferson Street. Another difference in the new building is its name. Siloam Springs Memorial Hospital will become Siloam Springs Regional Hospital, and Davis says it will focus on a four-county area that covers both Arkansas and Oklahoma.
We're very much dedicated to the city of Siloam Springs. We've always actually had a regional area that we've served. With our new affiliation to Northwest Health System, we can now bring more specialty services. We can continue to offer more specialized care for our community as a whole. So we felt that would speak more to a regional position than just Siloam Springs Memorial Hospital. So it has a little bit to do with our affiliation to Northwest Health.
She explains they are sister facilities because they are owned by the same parent company. Siloam Springs Regional Hospital is a $40 million project that created 75 construction jobs. Officials broke ground on the project in February of 2011, and Davis says they are actually finishing ahead of schedule. Guests arriving at the hospital have two options for entry. If you are facing the front of the building, the main entrance is located on the left. Walking through a pair of automatic sliding doors reveals an information desk and a waiting room for those visiting patients. On the right is the emergency entrance, which is open 24/7. Davis says the ER waiting room is 3 times larger than the previous one. After Davis leads me through a consultation room, we enter the ER proper. To the left, there are 5 rooms. 2 nursing stations are located in the center of the ER. To the right is another block of rooms. Straight ahead, you can see the new helipad through a glass door located on the eastern wall.
And one of the key improvements to the emergency department is the fact that we have our helicopter pad positioned conveniently just outside the ambulance bay. Currently, our emergency department staff has to take the patient from the emergency department all the way to the opposite end of the building to get to the helicopter pad, say if they needed to be airlifted to specialty services. So now they have that conveniently located right here across the ambulance bay. We have 2 trauma rooms here, and you can see that the doors are very expandable. They pop right out in case there needs to be quick access to that patient by extra staff, crash cart wheeled through, you know, whatever the case may be.
Those doors are also see-through, which makes it easier for employees at the nursing stations to keep an eye on critical patients. The new hospital building is also being outfitted with a number of technological upgrades. The old facility contained a four-slice CT scanner, but as we head down another corridor, Davis points out a new scanner, as well as some of the other new equipment the hospital has acquired.
This is our 64-slice CT scan. We've also added, just as an amenity, two dressing rooms so that our patients can take their time getting ready for that procedure or getting ready to go back home. Our MRI is right here. Key factor is that it's in-house. So again, much more convenient for our patients. Nuclear medicine equipment. And then from our radiology department, we move into our surgical suite. We have three operating rooms, and we've expanded those operating rooms from 300 square feet to 700 square feet.
As the hallway wraps back around to your left, Davis shows off the obstetrics department located on your right.
And we have six labor and delivery suites and two postpartum suites. And you can see that in our new labor and delivery suites, they're very spacious. There's sleeper sofa, sleeper chair. Each room has a private bathroom, and we now have the convenience of a storage room. And the reason that's important is because we can move all that equipment that maybe isn't being used at the moment into storage so that families have more room. It's not as cluttered. It's just more comfortable for that new mom.
The newly constructed Siloam Springs Regional Hospital also contains a center for OB triage.
What that means for our patients is if mom comes to the emergency department laboring, she does not have to be held in the emergency department. She can be moved to OB triage so that she's in the department, she's in her element, and we're ready to just move her right over into that labor and delivery suite when ready.
The nursery is located to the left of the OB rooms. It's surrounded by windows so guests can easily view the newest additions to their families. There is a waiting room with a television connected to a wall on the opposite side of the nursery.
This space is our family waiting area. And this is important because when those families are waiting, say maybe grandma or grandpa, and they are waiting for that new baby to arrive, they have a space to wait. And in the other building, they would often just have to wait in the hallway, which is not comfortable for anybody. So we're really excited to have this new for our families.
As we continue south down the hallway, another corridor appears on our right. This one houses a number of offices and the cafeteria, which has family-style dining and a few tables set up outside for those who want to eat outdoors. A short ride up an elevator leads to another nurse's station and a spacious waiting area with large windows on the second floor.
You know, and throughout the building, you can see that there are expansive windows throughout the entire building. Every patient care room, every inpatient room, every room in ICU, all of our OB suites have a window. So they have that natural sunlight coming in. Here you can see, you have a good view of the high school and the little pond. So this would be an area for families to utilize if they had, they're waiting for someone to come out of surgery or say they needed a moment away, you know, maybe out of the patient's room, you know, they could utilize that space to wait.
The second floor houses 28 patient rooms, and all of the rooms are now private. Each has a private restroom area that has a toilet, shower, and a sink. Other amenities include a corner closet and a television. The second floor is also the location of the intensive care unit.
Now we're moving along to our ICU unit, our ICU suite. Mm-hmm. And say you were going to visit an immediate family member, you would gain access to our nurses through this intercom system. Then they would give you access through these two doors. And then this, of course, leads you into the six ICU rooms. And one key point about these rooms, they're nice and large and they have the beautiful window, but there's a private restroom area in each of these rooms, which is something we've not had accessible to us.
Siloam Springs Regional Hospital will officially open at 6 o'clock tomorrow morning, which is also the time officials will begin transporting patients from the old hospital to the new one.
We have been practicing for months on, you know, what is the step-by-step process to safely transport those patients from the original facility to the new facility. We have assistance from a corporate transitional planner. So Community Health Systems has an individual that really specializes in this. And when this happens within their portfolio, she goes around to different facilities to help plan and execute the move from point A to point B. So we've had patient move drills, we've had tabletop discussions, we've gotten the city departments involved, such as emergency management services, those types of things, where they've been part of our drill and we've been communicating with them to make it a complete network of resources to move those patients safely from the facility on Jefferson to this new facility on Progress Avenue.
Davis says both facilities will remain in operation simultaneously for a time in case patients do go to the old hospital seeking help first. The next step for Siloam Springs Regional is to construct a 19,000 square foot single-story medical office on their 40-acre campus. Officials anticipate breaking ground later this year. More information is available at siloamspringsmemorial.com.
This is Ozarks at Large, and we are approaching, at least for campus purposes at the University of Arkansas, the end of spring.
We are approaching the end of spring, Kyle. It's the end of our academic year.
This is W. Dale Warren, and he is with me to talk about concerts Monday, April 30th and Tuesday, May 1st at Walton Arts Center involving UA campus bands.
Well, we have all four of our ensembles playing their last and final performances at the WAC this academic year, and we're always very excited. We get to say goodbye, which is hard for us, to our seniors and our graduate students that will be leaving us through graduation. But, you know, we've got this fantastic crop of new freshmen coming in the fall. So, you know, it's a renewal time as well as a time of reflection. And those students that have been with us 4 and 5 years have made a tremendous contribution to our musical program.
Does any thought of conclusion and renewal go into the construction of the program?
Absolutely. Just for the obvious reasons. We really do more of the heavy music in the midterm part of the semester. And then, as you'll see by the programming, even though there's some heavy music, even the anchor pieces have a entertainment or a light or lighter kind of affair. And so we think that that's appropriate, especially for this time in the year.
Let's talk about the Monday night concert, because there is something very familiar on there that we'll get to in a minute by someone named Bach.
Well, and that's very happy music,
yeah,
obviously. And so, you know, one of his most famous settings of Jesus' Joy of Man's Desiring, which you're referring to, the concert band is going to open their program with Fantasia in G, which is an incredibly uplifting piece, and it's very much a Bach-esque piece, but I say it's Bach and a Sprite commercial hybrided, a Sprite commercial at Christmas, you know,
right.
Even. It's so festive. But that's why those two are paired together like that. And then Morning Alleluias for the Winter Solstice, you can imagine that is totally uplifting. That came from a Hiroshima experience that Fred Fennell had when he woke up in a hotel room and the lights were coming in ablaze. And the morning, he just felt so fortunate for the people of that city that they had rebuilt and renewed and been able to overcome, obviously, that type of devastation. And then Chester is really a Civil War, Revolutionary War kind of piece by William Billings that William Schumann set. And it is that reflection type of piece. Where are we? Where are we going to go? How are we going to come out on the other end of it? And obviously, victorious is the answer to that. So that particular setting for the concert band is very much what you just described.
So that's the first half. That's the UA concert band.
Right.
Take a break. Small one. Wind Symphony.
Small, just change out. Right. We bring the Wind Symphony students on stage, and we open with Festive Overture. It doesn't get any happier for Shostakovich. He is quite pleased about Stalin's demise, when he wrote that. But anyway, it's an extremely fun and exciting piece. You know, difficult as nails, but nobody cares. I mean, you know, so it's just fun music. And Shostakovich at his best, in my view. Then the Seal Lullaby is Eric Whitaker's newest choral work, Set for Winds. And it's stunning. It's like your virtual choir, you know, Lux Aerum Choir, your virtual choir Sleep, your virtual choir Water Night. It's absolutely Eric Whitaker at his best. It's just a beautiful, beautiful, reflective piece of music. The Passing Bell is one of my favorite pieces in the repertoire. I think it's one of Warren Benson's best. He was a genius, of course, a percussionist with the Detroit Symphony and a head of composition at Eastman for many, many years. And he didn't get the credit he's due, but this was written in response to a student that was lost to Hodgkin's disease, who was the concertmaster at Luther College up in Iowa, and Weston Noble's director of bands and choral activities and orchestra. You know, he's one of the greatest guys in our business. And this impacted the entire school so strongly that Weston asked Warren to write this piece in honor of Dennis's memory. And they have a tradition in the Lutheran church that they do a bell ceremony, and the bell ceremony helps the soul ascend to heaven. And so that's what this piece is all about. It's based on the Overtone series of A Bell. It's the most sophisticated harmonic work I've probably ever dealt with, because you have many times 10, 11, 12 note chords going on because of all the overtones that are in play at that particular moment.
So several instruments are used to evoke that feeling of a bell?
Absolutely. I mean, we call the technique bopping, but it's just like what you'd hear a handbell choir do, where, you know, one note but you have to string those notes together. So all these different instruments are playing, but only one note at a time, or two or three notes, you know, but not simultaneously, or they're all in sequencing. We're a part of a commission back in 2010 for DJ Spar, who's a pretty remarkable young composer. He's actually a guitarist. But DJ's lineage is pretty remarkable if you look at the list of folks he studied with over his short number of years on the planet. But he wrote a piece called Precious Metal, a concerto for flute and winds, based on the three metals that a flute is made from. And the three movements are really great. And Rhonda Maines, our department chair, of course, is our flute professor, is doing a spectacular job with it, because he asks everything of a flutist you can ask in this thing. Every effect, every crazy, you know, tessitura thing. I mean, she's doing everything that a flute player could do, you know, aside of taking it apart and hitting it on something. I mean, you know, it's a remarkable piece. And then we're going to close with just one of my all-time favorites. It's my favorite Bernstein, and that's a hard thing for me to, you know, separate out. But we're doing the Symphonic Dances from West Side Story. And, you know, what do you say? I mean, I think it's his greatest symphonic work ever. He was more excited about this project than maybe anything. And then once he pulled the dances out for a full symphonic setting away from the pit orchestra of the theater where they did the Broadway show, I think this piece has got everything. I mean, there's no way not to leave tapping your toe with a big smile on your face.
It's a great one to let the curtain come down.
That's exactly right. That's why we put it there, of course.
Tuesday night, UA Campus Band will start things off. You'll be on stage again.
This is a fun program also. I mean, I'm really pleased with the way this is coming together. We're doing just a quickie fanfare by Dick Sacedo called Triumphant Fanfare. It's really modern, really cool color codes, chords, a lot of neat suspension, passing tone things, a lot of cool hemiola effect. I mean, it's just got a lot in a 3-minute piece. And then Ray Vaughan Williams, as you know, is one of my favorite composers, not just English, but period. And we're doing the Fantasia on a theme by Thomas Tallis, which is normally you don't hear this in a wind band setting, of course, you know, but Jay Bocook has done a tremendous setting for winds. Then we do the intro to Fisher Tull, a very complicated harmonic piece, but one that the students, I think, are really starting to get to. And we use this piece really to feature our percussion section. We have such a great percussion studio on our campus, and we're so deep. I mean, we have 30 killer players on campus, you know, so this really lets them shine. And then, you know, one of Henry Fillmore's greatest marches, Americans We, you know, and that's as happy as it's going to get. a new piece by Clifton Taylor called The Lark in the Clear Air, which is a flute piece with wind accompaniment. And Catalina Ortega, one of our flute instructors from Columbia, South America, just sounds like $1 million on it. I mean, it's just stunning. And then the last piece is another fun piece. It's called Scootin' on Hard Rock by David Holsinger. It's a set of three scat jazzy dances, but all very different dances, but scat singing, stuff you would hear in the honky-tonks and that kind of thing.
But will there be a vocalist?
No. Okay. We do it all through the instruments, right. But I've had to actually do scat to demonstrate the style, and I'm not really great at that. At least I have a rough voice, so that helps.
Then intermission on Tuesday night, and then the Symphonic Band.
Symphonic Band closes out the semester with the fanfare from La Prairie, Paul Dukas. Everybody, I think, loves that, particularly if you're a brass player. A new piece by Dana Wilson, fairly new, you know, in the last decade, called Shortcut Home. Really delightful and charming. Dana's got this kind of unique voice in the wind band composition world that all of us it's not quirky, but it's different enough where you never know what's coming next, and that's kind of what makes it delightful. And then another stunning piece by Carter Pan called Hold This Boy and Listen. He wrote for his nephew, and it is, if you're a dad or if you're a parent or you're a grandparent, this is just like having that little bundle of joy in your arms the whole time, and then watching that the growth and the maturity come about. And then they're going to close with one of the staples of the repertoire, the Persicetti Symphony No. 6 for band. But again, it's not a heavy symphony. It's very fun, very exciting, very beautiful. All four movements are quite different. And we think that that's going to really be a terrific way to close out our academic year.
$10 general admission, $5 senior citizen students, $1.
You got it.
Monday and Tuesday, the 30th of April and 1st of May.
We hope everybody will come out and enjoy the show.
Thank you, Dale.
Thank you.
It is Friday, the 27th of April, 2012. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
With us is Becca Martin Brown. She is the features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
This is a Dear Abby kind of day. We have advice from a foodie, advice from mom, and my advice that you should buy a Roots Festival ticket because John Prine, who did the song Dear Abby, is coming to Northwest Arkansas.
When you said Dear Abby, and this has been the case for 30-plus years, whenever I hear Dear Abby, I don't think of the advice column.
Really?
I think of the John Prine
song. Me too. Last first, John Prine headlines the Roots Festival on Saturday night, August 25th. Joined by performers like Trout Fishing in America, Tiffany Christopher, Emily Cates, and more. Mm-hmm. And you can find out more at FayettevilleRoots.com.
Tickets for the whole kit and caboodle are now on sale.
Mm-hmm.
And I will have one for John Prine or else. Advice from Mom will be available at 2 o'clock Sunday, when 14 local mothers like Lila Davidson, Gwen Rockwood, and Kelly Zager read their prose during Listen to Your Mother.
We're going to listen to 8 of them in just a few minutes on the program.
Excellent. You know, the event is part of a national series founded by a mom in Wisconsin, and the local version tackles adoption, embarrassing things that happen in parenting, loss, watching children grow up. Tickets are $18 at the Walton Arts Center box office, and all of the net proceeds will go to the Arkansas Visitation and Exchange Center.
Right.
And then there's foodie, journalist, author, and speaker Michael Pollan.
Coming to town on Thursday.
He has advice about eating when he kicks off the Walton Arts Center's Artisphere Festival. He is the award-winning author of several books, but his most recent is Food Rules and Eater's Manual.
Mm-hmm.
Among his advice, don't eat anything your great-grandmother wouldn't recognize as food.
Good advice.
Yeah.
Do all your eating at a table. Eat when you're hungry, not when you're bored. It's not food if it's served through the window of your car. It's not food if it's called by the same name in every language.
Nuggets.
Right.
And the banquet is in the first bite. The Artisphere kickoff also includes an opening reception for the new Structuring Nature exhibit, tickets for Michael Pollan's Q&A, which I believe is being facilitated by a guy named Kyle Kellums.
That's true.
Are $25 to $75 for adults, and Kyle's worth that on his own.
No, I don't.
You can find out more at artistspherefestival.org.
I guess if I'm eating a bowl of Lucky Charms while standing up in the kitchen, I'm breaking at least half of those rules.
Yeah, pretty much.
But are you happy while you're doing it? I mean, really, isn't that the question?
Well,
and
it's the long run that you've got to be concerned about, the long run.
I suppose.
Yes.
But Michael Pollan doesn't want, I mean, he just wants you to eat real food you cook.
He is not a finger wagger.
No.
He does it with great humor and whatnot.
Really interesting guy. Also this weekend, it's the Dogwood Festival in Siloam Springs.
So what annual, do you know?
No, but it's been forever.
20-something?
Yeah, I would think.
27?
I want to say 26, 27.
Yeah. Also a production of The Lion in Winter this weekend at Northwest Arkansas Community College. 7 o'clock today and tomorrow, 2 o'clock Sunday, and again next weekend. Tickets are $5 to $8 at 619-4126. Book of Days ends at the Art Center of the Ozarks in Springdale with shows at 7:30 tonight and tomorrow. Tickets are $10 to $20. Rogers Little Theater's second stage show is called Why Torture is Wrong and the People Who Love Them.
Right.
It's an indictment of the Bush administration. You should know that going in. But you should also know that our friend from Gridiron, Justin Stewart, is in it. And showtime is 8 o'clock today and tomorrow and 2 o'clock Sunday. Tickets are $10. The Fall of the House goes on this weekend. Theater Squared at Nadine Baum Studios in Fayetteville. Cabaret at University Theater in Fayetteville. The St. Petersburg String Quartet performs in Eureka Springs, a dinner concert at 5 o'clock Saturday at the Crescent Hotel and a concert at 2 o'clock Sunday at the City Auditorium. Both are benefits for the CICA Eureka Springs Music Festival. And the Arkansas Philharmonic wraps up its season at 7:30 Saturday at the Arend Art Center in Bentonville. Tickets are $20 for adults. And there's a whole bunch more in What's Up at nwaonline.com/whatsup. Up on our blog at NWA Source, NWA Tuned In, Facebook, Twitter. You get the idea.
All over the webs.
Yeah.
Thanks, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
This is Ozarks at Large. Sunday afternoon, 14 views of motherhood will be offered from the stage of Walton Arts Center as part of the show Listen to Your Mother. Writers, mostly from Northwest Arkansas, will share their experiences of raising children. This week, 7 of those participating writers, Kelly Zaga, Gwen Rockwood, Jocelyn Morelli, Shannon Hahn, Angie Albright, Shannon Maxim, and Leela Davidson, talked with me about Sunday's show inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio.
One thing that you all have in common, you all are mothers, right?
We are. Yep.
And that brings me to Sunday's event at Walton Arts Center that says, Listen to Your Mother. Leela, how did this come about?
This came about because a woman named Ann Immig in Madison, Wisconsin, a couple years ago, started this show, which is just a really simple concept of women or men, anyone, getting up and telling a story about motherhood to illuminate some aspect of their own motherhood or motherhood in their lives.
Sunday, there will be 14 people.
Yes.
So we'll hear 14 stories. How did you find the 14 voices?
We, Stephanie McCraddock and I, are producing the show locally. It's going to be in 10 cities this year. And we had a written call for submissions first. We had received about 50 submissions. And from that, we culled that down to, I think we saw 20 in a live audition. And, you know, it's really not about, you know, having the best or most dramatic story or any type of writing. It was just trying to get different voices and different aspects of motherhood represented.
Everybody here has written about motherhood either in print or online. Is that correct?
Yes.
I have not.
You have not.
But I talk about it. I do stand-up comedy. And I talk about it.
Is motherhood something that lends itself to stand-up comedy?
Either. Oh, no, not at all. There's no material there.
Without incrimination, what's a sort of event that could find itself in your stand-up comedy?
Well, sometimes I talk about my own mother. So there's that aspect where I talk about my mom, my mothering, and that. And then, you know, your children say the darndest things sometimes. And I don't know if I should give you any examples of what my daughter says, because I usually say it in you know, a stand-up comedy arena. But, yeah,
it's
you know.
It's a family show.
Yeah, it's a family show. She says some stuff, though. And I'm like, whoa, she's only 7, and she just knows things, you know. I don't know how she knows them, but she knows them.
It's a mystery.
Shannon, Maxim?
Yes.
You're one of the two Shannons in the room.
Yes.
You have been blogging about motherhood for a while.
Yes, since Gwen and I started NWA Motherload, I've had a blog, Life with Ladybug. And, yes, so been writing about, it's more about, you know, sort of my journey, but as her mother. So she's, you know, there's a lot of her subject material, definitely.
Shannon, what does blogging about motherhood allow you to do? I mean, because there's you know, you can blog as often as you want.
Yes, yes. I think it allows you to connect with other moms who are, it's, motherhood is universal. And I think that's kind of what this show is sort of is about. I mean, it's all aspects of all the different, you know, the crazy, the mess, the beauty, the chaos of motherhood, and just sort of laying it bare. And I think we were talking about this earlier. Moms are doing that more. It used to be sort of the rosy, you know, tampon commercial, you know, music in the background. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everything's beautiful and perfect. And so I think we're sort of unveiling that a little bit, moms, today with blogging and with things like this show.
Gwen, what drew
you
to?
Well, let's be honest. Sometimes it's payback, too. You know, when your kids do something, it's, you know, one time my kid was potty training, and he had an incident where he basically stripped down in the middle of a Chick-fil-A indoor playground and flashed all the little 3- and 4-year-old girls there. And I was mortified, of course, and picked him up and fled the areas, you know, as fast as I could go. But the whole way I'm going home, I'm going, that was horrifying, but I'm going to get a really great story out of it. You know, so sometimes you just got to take the material where you can get it, too.
What was the title of that post?
That title was Naked Nuggets.
We almost used that in the show. That was our sweet. We chose another of Gwen's pieces to use for the show, but Naked Nuggets was among the top choices.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say one of the things that even though I don't write a blog, I read them. And I was mentioning to them, I'm so glad with the honesty. There's so much honesty because as a parent, like Shannon was saying, you want to show this perfect, you know, family life or whatever. And it's just when you have the honesty, you think, okay, other women think I want to kill this child or what was I thinking? You know, like, I mean, there's been moments where I was like, what was I thinking? I had my child at 38. So I often get referred to, this is something in my stand-up, I get referred to as the grandmother. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll go somewhere and they'll say, oh, how, your granddaughter's so beautiful. And I'm like, okay, so I had a career. You know, I went to college, started my own company, and then I had a child. I know it's crazy, but, you know, there's just things like that that happen. And to be able to share that with other people and go, okay, that happened to her too. And I'm not alone. And I do think these things. And sometimes you feel guilty. But then you also get the illumination of the beauty of motherhood and how wonderful. I wouldn't trade it for the world. The worst days I would not trade, you know. So
part of the beauty of this show, I think, is that it gets people together who don't necessarily read blogs in their everyday life because they're too busy running a business or doing whatever they do. And so, I mean, blogs have proliferated the culture. However, not everyone reads these mothering blogs, and a lot of people don't get to hear these kind of stories on a regular basis. And if you're just kind of tunneling and going through your day-to-day life, and you may not know that other moms are actually struggling or doing embarrassing things that you are doing, it's nice to hear that.
Mm-hmm. It's affirmation. I'm not crazy.
I'm not alone. Mm-hmm. I'm not crazy. I'm not necessarily doing it wrong.
Some of you have children who are younger. Yes. Shannon Maxwell, how old is your?
10.
10. Mm-hmm. Some of you have teenagers.
Right. Yes.
Is there something that's still uniform between being a mother of a 4-year-old and being a mother of a 17-year-old?
You would be shocked at how similar they can be sometimes. I mean, they're learning things. They're growing. They're trying to figure out the world around them. And sometimes it's the same at my age, too, in my 40s. You're stumbling through new things. And then sometimes teenagers lose a few brain cells in there, and you think you're back to square one.
We have 5 children, and they range from 2 to 16. And it is very parallel, the things that they go through and want, from learning on a daily basis to fits, all of them. It doesn't change. And they all still want their mommy.
Mm-hmm. Plus, you're still figuring it out all the time. Okay, so I might know what to do with a 3-year-old, but I'm not quite sure what to do with a 14-year-old yet. I need to still learn that.
Right. You know, any memoir that is someone looking back at their life or talking about their life, there has to be some editing. And if it's a book, you have time to think, well, maybe I shouldn't put that in. Maybe with a blog, the time isn't as long. How much do you self-edit? How much, whether it's stand-up, whether it's a blog, whether it's a book, how much do you decide, you know what, I can't put that in? I'm looking at you first, Leela.
Well, I mean, my kind of rules are that if it's going to hurt somebody's feelings, I don't put it in. I try to never say anything negative online because it's just there forever. You know, I don't write about really heart-wrenching things. I think maybe it's a little easier because I know, you know, what people will laugh at. I know what my family, I know where their thresholds are. So we talked about this, I think, yesterday. For example, I write a lot about my marriage. I don't think I would write about a real fight in my marriage that was unresolved, for example. I write about things that we can already laugh about. So same with my kids.
Do you take an inner poll, though? Do you ask your husband or your kids ever, is this okay to write about, or do you have that sense?
I do, especially now that they're older, and you know, I write for Peekaboo magazine quite often, and sometimes the girls now will bring the stories into my son and you know, poke fun. And so we kind of have an understanding that I will get clearance. But then if they do something, you know, that I think the world needs to know about, I don't get their approval necessarily.
You know, I think in writing about those things, if you do it without any meanness, then you don't lose any credibility in your message. And I think a lot of what we see in the writings of these women is just really credible stuff. You know, it's real, it's life. Sometimes it's funny, sometimes it's tragic, but it's without any mean-spiritedness. And, you know, at the end of the day, all these things are written from love. And so with that position,
I think it shines through.
It does shine through, and that's a really compelling message. And I think that's why blogging is growing the way that it is that you see examples of people's love for their family and their friends and their communities.
And it's not about them. It's about us as a mother being able to express the truth of our experience. And I think that's why maybe in the past we've had all these insincere portrayals of motherhood because we wouldn't want to say anything that might reflect negatively on anyone in any circle associated with us. So we'll just pretend that everything's perfect. And that just does a disservice to everyone around us.
I've never been a mother, nor a father.
Probably never will be.
I have one. What did you not know before you were a mother that now you look back and think, oh, wow, of course?
I always say that I learned that whole argument between nature and nurture is so much more profound than you could possibly imagine. It's so much more nature. Genetically, I'm surprised by my child all the time. He's so much like us, his parents. But then other times, that nurture thing, I see that, and he's completely his own person. But both are so much more there than I could have possibly have imagined.
I think one of the things that I'm most surprised about, and I'm surprised about it every single day, is how much my daughter loves me. I didn't know that anybody would love me like that. She adores me, and it's so bizarre. I mean, sometimes she's mad and angry, but she's just like, Mommy, you know, it's just this whole responsibility of, you know, I always tell my mom, I'm trying not to make the same mistakes you made. My mom was a teenage mother, and I'm making my whole other set of problems that I'm actually saving up for a psychology fund. No college for her. It's going to be therapy. Yeah. So, you know, when you grow up, like, I keep thinking, you know, she loves me so much, and she's seeing me do things like listen to your mother. I'm doing this for my daughter. I like her to see, look what she's doing. She's doing stand-up comedy. She's doing theater. She's running a business. She's a single mother. And I want her to know that you can persevere and create.
I think one thing that none of our mothers were able to tell us, because you can't experience it until you are a mother, is how much it hurts to be a mother, how much you hurt for your child, whether it be out of physical pain that they're going through that you can't take away, or just your love for them. It's your heart is just so full for your child that it physically aches sometimes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Columnists, bloggers, writers, and moms, Kelly Zega, Gwen Rockwood,
Jocelyn Morelli, Shannon Hahn, Angie Albright, Shannon Maxim, and Leela Davidson visited me inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio yesterday. They'll be joined by seven other writers for Listen to Your Mother, Sunday afternoon beginning at 2 at Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville. The show is one of just 10 such programs across the country. Other cities included are San Francisco, Chicago, Washington, D.C., New York City, Philadelphia, and Austin. You can hear more from our conversation, including previews of what will be read on the weekend edition of Ozarks at Large, Sunday morning at 9. This weekend, the Arkansas Philharmonic Orchestra wraps up the season. And with me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio to talk about that, Stephen Bias, who is the conductor and musical director. Welcome back.
Always a pleasure.
When I think finales, I think fireworks.
Well, there certainly are a lot of musical fireworks this weekend. It's a program that started, and I should say, I build my programs around the soloist. We choose a soloist, decide what the repertoire will be with the soloist, and in this case was Prokofiev Piano Concerto No. 3. Yesterday was Prokofiev's birthday, and I thought, well, that's close enough to create a theme around this. Why not? Let's do a choral work and do this mighty work, Alexander Nevsky, on the second half of the program. And instead of adding something orchestral at the beginning of the program, I asked the choruses, and we're using the Master Chorale and Schola Cantorum from the University of Arkansas, and Todd Prickett, their director, said he'd love to collaborate again, and I asked him to do an a cappella work at the beginning of the program, and we chose Pavel Chesnikov's Salvation is Created to begin the program. And so we begin in a rather beautiful, somber way, but then the fireworks when this piano concerto begins are apparent. And of course, Alexander Nevsky, one of the great epic sweeping soundscapes of a work, and certainly one of the hallmarks of 20th century choral repertoire.
It has an interesting history from its namesake through the composition.
Nevsky is an extraordinary piece on so many levels that it was essentially a film score, mm-hmm. was remarkable. And in that vein, this relationship of the composer and the director of the film, Sergei Eisenstein, was so good that one of the few examples in cinematic history where some of the music was written before the scenes were filmed. Eisenstein believed in Prokofiev's ability to create ebb and flow in music and actually embraced some of the scenes of where the music was written, and he used it to pace and build some of his filming. And the Battle on the Ice, perhaps the culmination of the entire movie and the entire cantata as well, there is an extended section when the chorus, in this case, instead of singing in Russian, they're singing in Latin and singing some very interesting words that have their own history. But there's an extended section for the orchestra, which is an exact excerpt from the movie score. Such was the great extended nature of this scene, of this clash of the Russian people and the Swedish Teutonic Knights, that Eisenstein left it intact and extended what he had originally planned in filming, but Prokofiev leaves it intact also for the cantata. And it is, I think, the number one best example of musical cacophony ever written. We have this theme that's associated with the Teutonic Knights, and the instrumentation reflects this barbarism, using brass and percussion and very dissonant, discordant harmonies. And the Russian people, who are fighting against these invading marauders, always represented by the strings and the woodwinds in rather folk-like materials. And when the battle on the ice begins, we hear these themes stated rather simply, but as the fervor begins to build, the music is astonishing that we hear the Teutonic Knights theme in three different forms at one time, augmented in longer rhythmic values. All of this is giving the sense, musically speaking, of what it would be like to be in the middle of a battle, because then the folk materials will also come in different forms, all at the same time, in different registers and orchestrations with the winds and the strings, and it's absolutely brilliant.
What kind of conversations do you have with the musicians? Cacophony is an interesting word to use when you're talking about live music. Do you have conversations about, yes, this is, because it's a fine line between, if you're talking cacophony, it's a fine line between being too cacophonous and dissonant, but then also being representative of what the composer intended?
It's a great question. It contradicts what we do most of the time. Our desire to blend and collaborate sonically, orally, is paramount. I'm fond of saying that we must have collaboration, or the opposite will be chaos. Cacophony, when it comes, is very close to chaos. It really does ride that line between being that frenetic activity where you have the sense that so many things are going on at one time versus a chaotic approach. And at the height of this fifth movement of Alexander Nevsky, the orchestra is going full strength. And it's a large orchestra with added instruments, a lot of percussion, and obviously to represent the battle, this very barbaric battle, there are some clashing sonorities and harmonies and just the idea. It's almost aleatoric, where like Charles Ives or someone, where you hear different aspects coming from different directions. And it is a fine line and a difficult balancing act for any conductor to try and make certain the chorus is heard and that each of these themes has its own prominence but still works so that nothing is obliterated, musically speaking.
During rehearsal, do you walk to different parts of the venue to hear how it's sounding?
I wish I could do that. Often there's so little rehearsal time that I don't have the opportunity, but I do this some of the time. Really, this is one of those pieces that is sonically overwhelming, and I mean that in a positive
way. Right,
no. The way it begins, the entire seven-movement cantata version of Alexander Nevsky begins, is very simple. And small melodic fragments of the Russian theme and the Teutonic Knights theme intertwined with one another. And it's the sounds that Prokofiev create are having the strings play ponticello, which means putting the bow almost right over the bridge. And it gets a very steely sound, which creates a cold sound. So the actual text painting of the words is prominent, and that's part of the brilliance of Prokofiev. But it is important to balance these very simple beginnings to these massive combinations later in the piece, and it is very helpful to go out into the hall. I rely heavily on ears put throughout the hall, turning around constantly and asking if the chorus can be heard. Can you hear the flute? Are the celli drowned out at this section? And it is a real balance game, especially when your rehearsal period is so short.
This is the finale. So, you know, I guess you don't have a chance to think about that when you're preparing, that this is the last concert of the season. It is a concert, right?
Yes, and I take each of these programs equally and consider them with their intent, in which I created them programming-wise, to have the same effect on the audience. Certainly here at the end of the year, this is a fitting concert because doing a choral collaboration is a different dynamic for our concerts, and I love and am committed to doing choral collaborations. But this program is just like any other that we do. In addition to Alexander Nevsky, we're doing the Piano Concerto No. 3, and it is a knuckle buster, I like to say. It has a lot of glissandi. I mean, literally, it is physically demanding, and some pianists will say it is the most physically demanding concerto they have to play. It's reflective of Prokofiev's prodigious talents on the piano. Some of the things that are written are fiendishly difficult, and any pianist who commits to doing the Prokofiev Third Concerto and who can do it well is indeed a wonderful pianist. We were originally scheduled to have Yoram Ogulis, who is a professor at the University of Arkansas, collaborate with us, but he is indisposed because of someone who passed in his family. We're very sorry to not collaborate with him, but we hope we'll be able to schedule something in the future. I invited a friend, Jeffrey Beagle, who has as one of his signature works the Prokofiev Concerto No. 3.
Handy.
And he has performed this concerto countless times and is very fond of the work. And I knew that bringing him in at the last minute would ensure that the audience, the orchestra, everyone involved would have a wonderful experience with this extraordinary piece.
Well, congratulations on the almost completed season. Look forward to talking to you next year.
Thank you. I'm excited about the concert this weekend, and we're putting the finishing touches on next year's season. It'll be bigger and even better, so I'm excited to see you again and talk to you about each one of those.
You don't like to rest, apparently.
Oh, it's overrated.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Stephen Bias will conduct the Arkansas Philharmonic Orchestra's final concert of the season. That concert is Saturday night, beginning at 7:30 at Arend Arts Center in Bentonville. I talked to him inside the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio earlier this week.
The AMP Arkansas Music Pavilion presents country music recording artist Hank Williams Jr. with guest Jamie Johnson tomorrow at the Washington County Fairgrounds. Hank Williams Jr. has over 70 albums and CDs to his credit and last visited Northwest Arkansas in 1987. Tickets and more information are available at arkansasmusicpavilion.com. Support for KUAF comes from Carmike 14 Cinema in Fort Smith and Ballet and Cinema, featuring The Bright Stream live from the Bolshoi on Sunday, April 29th, with an encore performance on Tuesday, May 15th. Tickets and more information are available on the web at carmike.com.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda, a listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Siloam Springs.
Siloam Springs, which was named in Smithsonian, the latest issue of Smithsonian Magazine, as the 14th best small town in America.
Really?
Yep.
Very cool.
Yes. Let's see. Ithi Agnihotri Madolkar will be with you Sunday morning at 9. For Weekend Ozarks at Large. She'll also be handling Mondays.
She will.
Brand new show. Then you've got Tuesday and Wednesday of next week.
I do. You're going on vacation.
I'm going to walk away for a while.
It'll be good.
Yes. I'm looking forward to it. April has been a very busy month.
Yes.
We had the fundraiser. Everybody else had a fundraiser.
Yeah.
and just everyone was putting on shows. And I love living in a place where there's a lot happening. But this was the busiest month I think I can ever remember in Northwest Arkansas in the Arkansas River Valley.
Oh, my gosh. So much. I mean, I'm glad there are so many different organizations and so much to do. But,
right.
Yeah, I'm glad you're going to chill for a little bit.
I am. And let's see. Next month, Artisphere, things like that. It's not going to really slow down, but it's going to slow down a bit.
All the outdoor
commencements.
Commencements
like
and the outdoor music events.
Right. Oh, yeah. Summer jazz, the summer chamber music
Gully Park series.
Right.
All that good stuff.
We have a lot of music on the show, too, over the summer. All right. That's it. I'm going to take vacation.
All right. Have a good one.
I'm Kyle Callum. We already did that. I'm already on vacation. You can tell. Okay.
See you.
Bye.